If it hadn't been for Nixdorf, the entire Telex incident might not have happened. And to Pengo, it seemed that if the Telex incident hadn't happened, the entire spying business might have faded away. In early 1988, the local police in Munich needed to set up a high-speed data link between Munich and Federal Police Headquarters in Wiesbaden for all their Telex traffic. It was an unrewarding, time-consuming programming job because of the ad hoc nature of Telex communications. The police asked Nixdorf, a large West German computer company, to take it on, but Nixdorf was too busy, so Nixdorf farmed it out to a small software company in Berlin. That company had qualms about working for the police, so it subcontracted the work to NetMBX, Pengo's startup company, for 40 marks an hour. Suffering from lack of business, little NetMBX was in danger of folding before it had a chance to get off the ground. Clemens and Pengo were only too happy to take on the work. Pengo enjoyed the irony of it all. Not only was he a prominent West German hacker whose name was known to the authorities, but he was one with leftist leanings who had been doing business with the Soviets. And now his firm was going to be responsible for setting up communications between two state police headquarters. Mindful of the problems Pengo might encounter if he were so brash as to go to police headquarters in Munich himself, in late March he dispatched Clemens. Clemens spent 2 days in Munich working on the link. When he had finished, he asked the police in Munich to send a series of sample telex transmissions, which he then copied onto tape and took with him back to Berlin for use in testing. When he got home, Clemens printed out the telexes and showed them to Pengo. Pengo was highly amused. Among the missives were a death threat allegedly sent by the Red Army faction terrorists to West Germany's research minister and the travel schedules of two top police officials, complete with the security measures planned for the trips. When Hagbard came to Berlin to visit a few weeks later, Pengo couldn't resist showing him the telexes. Hagbard wasn't doing quite as well. Since early 1987, he had been in and out of psychiatric hospitals and detoxification centers. He was recovering from a difficult love affair with an American diplomat who had returned home, and he was more convinced than ever of the Illuminati's grip. But now he was turning the world's problems into his own scourge. He believed that the AIDS virus had originated with him as a means for annihilating the Illuminati, that the letters were in fact short for Anti-Illuminati Destruction System. To make things worse, Hagbard's inheritance had long since run dry, and his drug dependency was acute. So when a new set of journalists from Hamburg approached him while working on a story about computer break-ins, he told them that he was one of the most powerful and talented hackers they would ever encounter, but that his story came at a price. He told them he could steal his way into most anything. They wanted to see proof, so they paid him 500 marks to come to Hamburg and stay for a week in a good hotel. They even paid for Pengo to come, too. Germany's computer hackers were accustomed to seeing some reward for revealing their secrets. Usually these were informal arrangements, a filling meal in a nice restaurant, round-trip train fare in exchange for a window into hacks at CERN or Thomson Brandt. The two journalists told Hagbard and Pengo that if they could publish the story in a German magazine such as Quick, substantially more money would be forthcoming. While they had Hagbard there, the two journalists sat him down with his back to the camera and interviewed him about what it was like to be a hacker. They also had him compose a hacking manifesto of sorts, complete with his theories on Hagbard Selene and the Illuminati. In his 7 pages of rambling prose, Hagbard disclosed that the National Security Agency was operating a secret department called OSAD, the Offensive Software Applications Department. There, Hagbard said, NSA was preparing for a war of the future, a computer war fought with soft bombs, computer viruses. Hackers, therefore, represented the pivot of the world's fate. Yes, Hagbard concluded, the computer war, our soft war, has begun. But when the journalists put Hagbard in front of a computer, he had trouble backing up his extravagant claims. He tried and failed to get into Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, a research center and think tank near Boston, and again into the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Hagbard was simply going to have to produce something more convincing, so the telexes came in handy. When Pengo showed him the telexes that Clemens had collected, Hagbard seized the opportunity. He persuaded Pengo to let him have some of them and presented them to the two journalists as a product of hacking, claiming that he had gotten them from Pengo, who had broken into the police computers in Munich. By now, it was July 1988, 3 months since the Matthias Speer story. But rather than diminishing with time, the story of Marcus Hess and the system manager in Berkeley was still making headlines in West Germany. The publicity was beginning to frighten Pengo. It wasn't so much the quick story itself that worried him as the mention of the Laszlo Below letter. Pengo knew nothing of SDINet or Laszlo Below, but it made Pengo queasy. Everyone in the country was talking about espionage. Pengo had a brief conversation with Hagbard about it, and he asked Hagbard how much he thought the authorities knew about their role in the entire affair. But it was useless. Hagbard was crazier than ever. He was beginning to talk to too many journalists about too many things. Pengo had a brief conversation with Dobb to discuss Hagbard's loosening lips. Dobb assured him that no one believed anything Hagbard said anymore. But Amon and Lenhardt, the two television reporters who had broken the Chaos NASA hack story, had heard about Hagbard's telex story and were on their way to Berlin to question Pengo about it. Amon was also curious about Below. He was convinced that something was going on involving the East, and when the head of Panorama suggested to Amon that he look into this story about police telexes, Amon agreed immediately. The perplexing telex story was reason enough to go to Berlin for the day and talk to Pengo. Pengo didn't show up for the interview. When the journalists called him, he apologized and said he had forgotten about it, so they made a date for later that night. Amon, Lenhardt, and a third reporter, Gerd Meisner, a gifted young freelancer, took Pengo to a crowded and smoky café, a student hangout near West Berlin's Technical University. Amon was struck by the streetwise ways of Pengo, who did not conform at all to the picture of hackers Amon had developed back in Hamburg. Instead of a social maladroit, Amon was greeted by an amiable and appealing 19-year-old. After ordering one of the most expensive dishes on the menu and falling on his food like a starving man, Pengo set the record straight about the telex incident. "Fine," the journalists said, but now they wanted to know about Marcus Hess. A mystery in that his name had never before surfaced in connection with West Germany's hacking scene. "What about the Hess story?" Amon asked. "How well do you know Hess?" "I don't know him at all," Pengo responded, fairly shouting to raise his voice above the surrounding din. "Well, what about hacking and espionage?" Amon asked. "I don't know anything about hacking and espionage," Pengo insisted. Amon wouldn't give up. "What about those keywords, NORAD and SDI? Pengo shrugged. Amon changed his tack. "What about the letter from Below?" By this time, Pengo had consumed 3 tall beers and he was beginning to loosen up. The question about the Below letter sent him over restraint's edge. "Okay," he said calmly, as if he had hit upon an afterthought. "It's true that some software has been passed to the Soviet Union, but it didn't amount to much." He told them that a contract had been made in East Berlin with a Soviet agent named Sergei. Lenhardt said nothing, but Meisner nearly slipped out of his chair. Amon's first reaction was not to believe it, and he asked Pengo to back up his claim. So maintaining his cool, speaking as if he might be noting a change in the weather, Pengo told them the story of Helmstedt. Helmstedt, a quaint border town in West Germany, was the police checkpoint to the East German highway leading to Berlin. It was where Westerners traveling to Berlin by car were stopped and their papers scrutinized by a lineup of stiff young border guards. As Pengo had heard the story from Peter Karl, when Karl wanted to make his initial contact to agents in the summer of 1986, he slipped a small piece of paper inside his passport at Helmstedt, which he had written something in code, expressing his desire to talk to someone about technology transfer. When he got his passport back, more than an hour later, he found a second note inside, containing a telephone number, the number of a contact at the KGB. The Helmstedt story, of course, had been another of Karl's grand illusions, but Pengo believed it. So did the journalists. It was classic, the journalists decided, and it must be true. What, Amon asked the surprisingly calm young hacker, did he plan to do now? Pengo looked as if that were the first time he had considered the question. Well, he said, he had been out of the action for more than a year now, and he was hoping the whole matter would simply die on its own. This was one story Amon did not want to lose, but it also presented a tricky situation. He could hardly base a potentially explosive story on the word of one 19-year-old, but if he started sniffing around, he could endanger Pengo. Moreover, it hadn't taken any grand effort to pry the story loose from Pengo. Given the fact that he had forgotten about the interview at first, Pengo probably hadn't intended to bare his soul. There was no telling, given a few beers, whom else he might entrust with this information. And as a freelancer, Amon didn't have the resources to post Pengo to Elba or another suitably isolated island until he could confirm the story. On one hand, Amon was surprised that something like this hadn't happened earlier. He and other journalists who followed the hacker scene had often discussed the likelihood that hackers would become spies. But Amon saw that the confluence of friends, circumstances, and drugs had created a perfect setting for what Pengo was describing. Hagbard seemed to be dependent enough on drugs to look for any route to easy money, and Pengo struck Amon as a quirky mix of naivete and shrewdness. Aside from seeing Pengo each year at the Chaos Congress and observing his steady rise to the top of the hacking scene, Amon didn't know much about the smooth and accomplished hacker from West Berlin. Mostly he knew him as a bright, opinionated young man, something of a would-be anarchist, somewhat distanced from the rest of the Chaos group. Now he seemed at once oblivious to the consequences of what he had done, and hardened in a way that Amon hardly expected from a teenager. It didn't surprise Amon to learn that this youth had been traveling to East Berlin to deliver the fruits of his electronic marauding in America and West Europe. If he was telling the journalists this much, it was highly likely that there was a lot more to the story. The three journalists told Pengo he should think carefully about what to do, but that just letting the situation sit was probably not the best idea. By the time they left the cafe, Pengo was trembling visibly. A few days later, Amon and Lenhart returned to Berlin, and by then Pengo was truly anxious. Pengo told the journalists that he wanted their help in getting out of the entire mess. One way Amon knew to assure an exclusive story was to gain Pengo's trust, even to go so far as to put him in touch with the right people.
Amon called Ulrich Sieber, a law professor, attorney, and computer crime authority in Bayreuth, a small university town in southern Germany, best known for its annual Wagner Festival.
The 37-year-old Sieber hardly seemed the most natural choice to defend a hacker spy from Berlin. He was well respected in the Federal Republic as an attorney who represented corporations deprived of their rightful profits at the hands of software pirates. But Amon also knew him to be fair and, in his own way, open-minded. When Amon called Sieber, the journalist was circumspect in his description of the case. He explained simply that there was a hacker who had a problem and needed advice. With no specifics in hand, Sieber agreed to devote a Saturday to discussing the case in person with Amon and the unnamed hacker.
Gerd Meisner was put in charge of chauffeuring Pengo from Berlin to Bayreuth, a 6-hour drive. He had to pick Pengo up at his father's house at 5 a.m. in order to get to Bayreuth in time.
When they arrived at Sieber's university office, Amon was already there. A relentlessly cheerful and proper man, Sieber was friendly and gracious to the threesome, and he made clear his desire to help with whatever the problem could be. Pengo appeared calm, perhaps even a bit uninterested in the whole affair. "Yeah, there are some problems," he told Sieber as he sat down and gestured to his two companions. "These guys say I should talk to you about it." Sieber asked Pengo to tell him exactly what had happened. Pengo was reluctant at first, even slightly distrustful of Sieber, whom he knew to be no proponent of computer hacking. But Sieber assured him that his story would be safe with him. So, rolling cigarette after cigarette, Pengo came forth with the story. He told of Carl's contacts with Sergei, of his own visit there, and of the various pieces of software that Carl had delivered to East Berlin. He described his own deliveries, the security program, the assembler from Thomson Brandt, and the session logs. And he described what he thought the others had sent over. He told of American military sites, of source code, and of logins to sensitive computers throughout the world. When Pengo was finished, Sieber sat back in his chair. The two journalists spoke first. They wanted to know what the options were. They asked what Pengo's rights were and what loopholes, if any, Sieber could find for him in Germany's computer crime statute. Pengo inquired about the possibility of trying to forget about the whole thing and disposing of evidence. Expert though he was, Sieber wasn't quite sure where to start. He was certainly riveted by the tale. As a youth, he had taken his English studies partly by way of Ian Fleming's James Bond stories, and in at least one small aspect of his work, he had managed to find a common connection between the world of international intrigue and the relatively obscure realm of computer security. In his otherwise dry writings on the topic of computer crime, Sieber had warned a decade earlier that hackers could easily fall into the hands of the KGB. Few people believed Sieber at the time, and some of his most ardent detractors had dismissed him as a publicity seeker. So for Sieber, it was a clear vindication of his theories to learn of such a case. First, he issued a polite but firm warning that if Pengo had any intention of destroying evidence, he had come to the wrong lawyer. Then, thinking out loud, he expressed his first reaction to Pengo's predicament. It was clearly not so much a hacking case as one of espionage. It was patently criminal and a serious offense at that. As for Pengo's idea to forget about it and let the whole thing blow over, Sieber said that was one option to consider. But as a pragmatic lawyer, he advised against it, explaining that it could hang over Pengo's head for years and could someday be used by the Soviets to blackmail him, even 10 or 20 years hence, when Pengo had a family and a job to protect. Another problem was that some of Pengo's friends might already have informed others of what they had done, thus placing Pengo in a great deal of danger. Pengo said he thought it was entirely possible that Hagbard had already said more than he should, and that worried him. Sieber's second suggestion to Pengo was that he inform the authorities himself. As it turned out, West German law contained an amnesty provision for espionage. If a West German citizen-turned-spy gave himself up to the state before the crime was discovered, and if turning himself in prevented further damage to the Federal Republic, he could receive full immunity from prosecution. Sieber was familiar with the provision because he had tried and failed to convince the German parliament to adopt a similar provision for hackers when it adopted its hacking law in 1986. No sooner had Sieber mentioned it than Pengo latched on to the idea. It seemed like a perfect escape hatch. It had been a long time since he had called Dobb and Carl his friends. Hess, he hardly knew, and Hagbard seemed too confused and unpredictable to protect in any case, so he had no qualms about betraying them. Sieber warned that if Pengo did turn himself in, amnesty wasn't necessarily guaranteed. There would always be the risk that the authorities would choose to prosecute him anyway. Sieber told the group he knew of someone from the Bundesamt für Forschungsschutz, the German domestic secret service. As it happened, Sieber had been at conference some time earlier, where he had met a Verfassungsschutz officer and sometime security consultant who had given the lawyer his card. Sieber asked Pengo if he would like him to try to reach the man at home. Pengo nodded, and Sieber disappeared into the next room to make the call. He re-emerged 10 minutes later to report that he had reached the officer and, just as Amon had, explained the problem without mentioning a name. The Secret Service contact needed some time to think things over and would call back within the hour. So the group settled down to wait for the return call. Amon found the incongruity of the scene entertaining. Here was one of West Germany's leading experts on computer crime, in his conservative blue suit, seated across a desk from one of West Germany's most prominent hackers, clad in his Berlin black sweatshirt and black jeans, nervously rolling cigarettes. And Sieber seemed more than willing to take on this unpredictable young man's case. It was, in some ways, he decided, a perfect hack. Only once in Sieber's questioning of Pengo did incredulity register on the lawyer's face. "Did you have any scruples about what you were doing? And did you consider whether it was unethical?" Sieber asked Pengo. "I don't care about ethics," came Pengo's flat response. "If it's Russian interests or Western interests, I don't care about that stuff." After a pause, Sieber suggested that such sentiments would hardly constitute a solid defense, and he recommended that Pengo not stress that line of thinking in his talks with the authorities. An hour later, Sieber's telephone rang, and the Secret Service contact said he was willing, just as Sieber had been, to devote a day of his weekend to hearing about the case without knowing any names.
He said he and two colleagues would drive to Bayreuth from Cologne the following day, Sunday. Amon and Meisner drove home, and Sieber suggested he get Pengo a room in a nearby hotel. Hartmut Pohl, one of the Verfassungsschutz computer security specialists, showed up in Bayreuth early the next day with two colleagues. One of Pohl's companions was a senior officer and more of a generalist. The other, an old hand at intelligence work, was to become Pengo's regular contact. Sieber met with them privately first and, still withholding his client's name, attempted to strike a deal with them. Finally, it was agreed that if Sieber's client agreed not to dissemble in the slightest, then his chances for amnesty would be excellent. And so, the interrogations began. The first session, that Sunday, lasted 4 hours. Sieber wasn't one to underestimate the reach of the KGB and the East German Secret Service when they wanted someone out of their way. Concerned for his client's safety, when the interrogation was over, Sieber insisted that Pengo not travel by train back to West Berlin, a trip that would take him across East Germany, and that he fly instead.